This is episode 13 of season 4 of The Bad Apples. If it's episode 13, it must be unlucky. So what's more unlucky than proprietary operating systems? So this episode I'm going to talk all about all just proprietary stuff. No open source free software on this episode. No, I'm kidding. I am going to talk about proprietary operating systems, though, and it just kind of worked out that way. And first I'm going to rant about a particular proprietary operating system, because I haven't done that lately. Then I'm going to talk about how I go in and make proprietary operating systems a little bit less proprietary when possible. And then I'm going to talk about which distro that I choose in particular in different cases for users that I'm setting up systems for and why I choose them. So stay tuned. First of all, it really annoys me when people lump OS X by Apple in with free and open source software, quote unquote, or open source software projects. Anyone working at Apple or with Apple will tell you that Mac OS X is not free and it is not open source. And I know what you're thinking, all these flags are flying up right now, and you're saying, well, yes it is, it's based on BSD, most certainly is. It's the very definition of free. Well, okay. Granted, there are parts of OS X that are very, very open source. And very free. Very BSD free. That's not GNU free, but it's BSD free. And in some people's eyes, that's better free, and in other people's eyes, that's not quite as free. It all depends on your perspective. You probably know my perspective. I'm going with the GNU stuff, but that's not why I say it's not free, and the reason I'm saying it's not really that free is because the entire GUI is not free, and it's not open source, and the applications are not free, and they're not open, and I realize that it all sits on top of a free BSD base with a mock kernel called Darwin that is free. You can go to the page, and you can download every single file that you need to compile Darwin and compile it. And it will work, supposedly. Haven't tried it myself, but you can do it, and it will work. You can build up a system, you could do like a Darwin from scratch project. But there are a couple of points that I think are worth mentioning, and the first one is that Apple didn't choose this free BSD thing for any idealism or freedom or even quality. They chose it because it was code that they could use that was stable, they didn't have to reinvent it, and there was no GPL obligation to redistribute. And that is like a business. You know, that's a business choice. And it's obviously a good business choice because they're getting great code. The problem I have with BSD, of course, is that it's great code and now they get to take it and they don't ever have to give anything back to BSD at all, which is great for them, not so great for really anyone else. That's very independent and it's very noble and very cool, the BSD people that allow that to happen. It really is. I mean, I have a certain admiration for that kind of thing where it is literally you do something and it's out there and people can do with it whatever they please. Whether or not a business is going to respect you enough to do you any favors, probably not. And I think that without the GPL, we wouldn't have anything that we have today in terms of Linux. The only Unix system that you could get onto would have been a big mainframe somewhere or a big company, and then you wouldn't be able to have that at home. So it's not, I don't think that most of what's really, really successful right now in probably what is the most popular, really user-centric Linux, you know, Unix distribution, that would be Linux, I don't think it would be here without the GPL, so my problem with BSD. The other point is that most users of OS X have no idea what Unix or BSD is. Not that that's really a problem per se, but they're not really using the free stuff. They're using the proprietary stuff. They are being restricted by the proprietary stuff just as much as they're being restricted by any other proprietary software. So the free code, yeah, it was free for Apple, but who's it benefiting? It's not really benefiting their users, except that it's a solid system, and it's not benefiting the users because they're not getting to do anything. You know, they're not getting the benefits of free software. I could be wrong, but as I see it, as I perceive this, there's a little bit of interest, you know, as Macintosh computers sort of start getting more into the mainstream and getting more of the, I guess, the market share or whatever. There is kind of a tendency for a lot of people within the free and open source community, quote unquote, that are getting a little bit interested in the whole Mac thing because, well, I mean, let's face it, if they're new to Mac, which of course I'm not, so I have a, like this kind of unique sort of cynical, you know, I've been burned by Apple attitude. But, I mean, newcomers to it, I can imagine that they would be fascinated by this and really, really like it. I mean, really like it. Because I was sitting next to a friend while she was uninstalling Vista and trying to install XP on a computer that she'd bought. She didn't want Vista. She tried it out. She hated it. She wanted XP back. It took her a lot of frustration to get this thing up and running, and I was shocked at how awful the system that I was witnessing her struggle with really was. I mean, I've heard bad things about Windows. I have never really had to deal with it on a personal level. I wouldn't want to ever have to deal with it, but seeing the forum posts and the tutorials and the things that she had to go through, and then the ridiculous driver install wizards that they've got that don't seem to ever work, the command line that doesn't seem to have really a whole lot of functionality, the completely puzzling structure of their file of their system, the files in their system. I can just imagine why people tired of that might look at OS X and think, wow, well that it really is cool because we've got, at least we do have access to the Unix stuff and we can really interface with it a lot easier. And that's fine, but it doesn't make it a free and open source project in my mind. I would be very interested in hearing about what Apple has contributed back to the community. It's not like they've actually make it that well known. You know, they've got their own little MacForge site set up so that you can come and contribute to them. I'm not really seeing a whole lot that they push back upstream, basically. The whole free desktop thing that Apple does they do ship with their system as an optional install. That's there, and I know that there are a couple of people working on that, or one. And whether or not they contribute back, I'm not really sure. I haven't looked into it. But I don't know just how much back and forth there is, and I've heard a couple of different stories about how Apple has not been very forthcoming in their returns back to a project. Or if they have given back, it's been in such a way that it seems, you know, that it's just almost, you know, it just requires a whole bunch of sorting through, and it's doing the letter of the law, but it's not being a good sportsman. It's not good sportsmanship, as it were. So, I mean, what's the excitement here? The excitement over OS X and the whole open source philosophy behind OS X is the fact that I too can contribute code to the company. I mean, I guess I could have done that all along, right? Even when they were completely closed, I could have just said, hey, I wrote an application, and just email it to them or mail them the code and just say, there, do with it what you will. I mean, that's not that big of a deal to me that I can contribute to Apple. Big deal. It needs to be a two-way conversation or it just doesn't work for me. The bottom line is the whole package, for me, at least. If you show me, let's say Snow Leopard, if you show me that I can go and get all the code for everything that everyone's getting with Snow Leopard. Snow Leopard, by the way, is famously dropping support for the PowerPC. So can I go get all the Snow Leopard code and download it and then compile it for a PowerPC computer? Probably not. Then it's not free and open source, is it? I mean, that's the bottom line. If I can't do with the code what I need to do, then it's not free software. And when they start locking parts of the code up, that's when it starts to become restrictive. That's the problem I have with OS X, is that there's a lot of stuff in there that's completely off limits for me, and that, to me, makes it not a free project. Application niches free software has been able to fill. And it's almost a little bit surprising as to just how many they have. The reason I was thinking about this is because a friend of mine had just gotten a Mac and immediately, of course, called me over to help them with it because, you know, they didn't even want to open the thing until they had me there ready to perform some kind of not quite specified magic. I went over to his place. He had the computer still in the box. So I opened it and immediately reinstalled the system. And this is probably what any geek would do if they were called over in a similar situation. No matter what system it is, I mean, the default is just not going to really be something that you want to start working off of, probably. I mean, if I know geeks, and I know geeks, they're going to do a reinstall. And the same thing with OS X. So I did a reinstall, left out a whole bunch of useless, you know, like 3 gigabytes of drivers, left out a whole bunch of language translations, and, you know, all this other stuff that they do default. They do install by default. I also included one of the things that they don't install by default, X11, because there are a lot of Unix applications out there that really are quite handy. And this is part of the cool thing about looking at what niche free software has actually been able to fill, because there are actually some applications that I ended up installing on this guy's computer that he loves. I mean, they basically made the Mac for him. I mean, I think without that, I don't think he'd be using the computer. But the other thing that I did to make it a lot less repulsive to me was I did partition the hard drive so that there was a little tiny 8 gig partition at the end of the hard drive, specifically for a Linux partition. And I installed Fedora 10 on there, and I'll get into that a little bit later, but it was, you know, I wanted him to be able to see the competing, or, you know, the other side of things. And I just did it as an 8 gig thing because I figured he's not going to go into it too often, but he was familiar with Linux. He had heard about it, and that's what I mean by familiar. He'd never used it, but a guy at his workplace was talking about it, and so when I mentioned it under my breath, he kind of got interested and said, okay, we'll go ahead and put Linux on there as well. We went ahead and did that. But before I get into that good stuff, I have to maintain the unlucky 13 trend of this episode and talk about the proprietary end of things. So after I got everything kind of reinstalled and reconfigured and stuff, I started kind of going through meticulously through the applications directory and just started pruning things out, or basically swapping things out. So it's kind of neat. And I, again, I'm just kind of amazed at how much free software has been able to fill for the software needs of the people. So the first thing that I did, I mean, on OS X, it's kind of easy. I mean, you either go to the /applications directory, or you just look down at the dock and you figure out that, okay, there's a whole bunch of applications here that I know this user is going to either use right away, or as they get more comfortable with using a computer, they're going to start kind of asking about, you know, what about this kind of application? What does this one do? So I just went ahead and swapped everything out. So Safari went out the window. That was gone, of course. Safari is their web browser. Now it's Firefox, and that's their default web browser, and that's the one in the dock, and it's in their applications folder, and they never have to open up Safari, which is a good thing. The next one, of course, was their mail client. Toss that out and add Thunderbird. Thunderbird can actually be not only their mail client, but it could also be their RSS reader, because there's an RSS option in Thunderbird, which I didn't really, I think I did know it, but I didn't really realize it. And then when I started, you know, I kind of had the idea of getting the podcasts into the, straight to their Thunderbird, because they're going to be in Thunderbird anyway, checking their Gmail, which he already had set up. So I set up Thunderbird with his Gmail account and a whole bunch of, like, good beginning kind of Linux podcasts, like Going Linux, The Bad Apples, The Techie Geek, you know, the good kind of, like, getting started ones. I don't know if mine actually applies, but, I mean, come on, he knows me, so I'm going to put my podcast in there. Office application, of course, they don't ship with an Office application on a default configuration of an Apple, so OpenOffice was something very, very welcome. And at first I was going to put in a different version of OpenOffice that was a little bit, that used a lot of the native kind of APIs of OS X, and then I decided to go ahead and put in OpenOffice because it, that way it will look and feel and be exactly the same as the OpenOffice over on his Linux partition, so I did that. Songbird instead of iTunes, which is a wonderful, wonderful thing. Songbird, I mean, again, it looks and feels like iTunes, so I don't actually use it, but to a user like this guy, I mean, there's no difference between Songbird and iTunes, so that's great. Adium is a OS X only chat client, similar, you know, to Pigeon or something good like that. It's open source. There's Transmission for BitTorrent client. Of course, Apple does not ship with a default BitTorrent client, I mean, obviously. There's a great little project called iTerm, that I prefer to use rather than the terminal that Apple ships with. iTerm is a lot more robust, a lot more flexible, and again, open source, has a SourceForge project page. It's pretty nice. On my own system, of course, I'd be using Digicam. Well, on my own system, I wouldn't have OS X at all. It would be a single boot, either Slackware or Fedora system. But if I was stuck using a photo management application in OS X, it would be Digicam. That wasn't going to happen for this user. He has a lot of Gmail stuff already established. So it was Picasa for Mac. And then, again, kind of keeping in mind that I was hoping he would kind of flirt with Linux and OS X kind of concurrently, so I went over to the Linux side of things and installed the Linux version of Picasa over there. So now either partition that he boots into, he's going to find really, really familiar and, you know, sometimes exactly the same kinds of applications. So we've got the Picasa for the photo manager and kind of online sharing kind of stuff. VLC replaces pretty much anything that plays multimedia. I mean, in my mind, it replaces iTunes, but a lot of people like that kind of structured, you know, big bucket of media that is iTunes or Songbird. But at least VLC will replace things like QuickTime and DVD player and things like that. And then I installed Handbrake, which, of course, Apple does not ship any equivalent of, even though Apple claims to be a multimedia kind of super uber hub. They don't seem to be able to understand that you need to get media in from different sources. That's just something that they don't seem to support or believe in at all. Another thing they don't seem to support or believe in are free codecs. So go to ZIF and you can find all the different components that you need for AUG support and stuff like that. And then a whole host of X apps and X, you know, things that are going to interact via the X server. Which, again, I mean, it's really not integrated, unfortunately, with the Mac interface. There's a big, big problem with that. It really kind of reduces some of the functionality. Certainly, if given a choice, I'm not going to use, you know, GIMP on an OS X box. If I could, even if I had to reboot into Linux, I would prefer to do that. The integration's just not there. But having said that, to someone who really has no other apparent option, GIMP and Inkscape, SuperTux, SuperTux Cart, Crimson Fields, WGET, you know, just all these random applications straight out of like Mac ports or Fink Project, which are of course the Unix ports of tried and true Unix apps over to the Mac platform. These were the applications, the truly foreign ones that you had to actually literally port over to the platform. These were the ones that really impressed him the most. And this was really cool to see because, you know, I mean, of all the Mac stuff that they could have sold him, none of them seemed to compare with the free ones that he was getting from me. And yeah, I mean, he could have gotten, for instance, well, okay, so he was completely against getting something like iWork, which is their quote-unquote office suite, which is a joke. I mean, it's not an office suite, but it does allow you to type into documents, so that would be the closest thing that you got. So, I mean, he could have gotten that, but he recognized from the demonstrations that this just was not a serious office application, and so he did not get it. iLife was cool, but he felt he was overwhelmed by it. And iLife being the one with like iMovie and GarageBand and all this other stuff in it. And so a lot of these things were either impressive to him, but prohibitively expensive, like Photoshop, or they were within his price range, but just didn't feel right to him. And so getting the stuff for free, like GIMP instead of Photoshop, Inkscape instead of Illustrator, which, I mean, Illustrator is such a mammoth, I mean, you'd never be able to understand it. So that was a sort of a knowledge level barrier, you know, just the learning curve was too steep. Whereas Inkscape, in my mind, a lot simpler interface to use, and yet it's just as powerful. And you've got your free tutorials online at screencasters.heathenx.org, which I told him about and downloaded some episodes for him and added that RSS to his Thunderbird after he got interested in it. So, I mean, these are really powerful applications with a lot of not just, you know, it's not just the free price tag that is appealing. There's a lot of appeal in terms of it's just as powerful as what he needs, or it can be used for what he needs without dipping too great, you know, too deep into the powerful aspects of it. Or it might be more powerful than what he needs, but it's the right price. Or it seems like the learning curve isn't as steep, or whatever. So this was really neat to see his eyes light up over all these free replacements. And it really amazed me. I mean, after a while, I was literally looking for things that that I could replace, and there was just nothing left. I'd replaced everything. The address book I didn't replace because there's, you don't have to replace it. It's built into Thunderbird. The calendaring application, which on the default system, OS X, it's like its own little application, but you can just add that in to Thunderbird with the Lightning add-on. So you've got a lot of things that are, that might not have their own separate icon, for instance, but there, the functionality is there, and in some ways even better, because there's even a plug-in. If he wants to do his little Google Calendar thing, he can do that within Lightning as well, or not within Lightning, but with a different, like it's a Gmail plug-in or something like that. So lots of different options. All I had to do was go through his applications folder and just literally identify the icon, identify what that software function was. Right off the top of my head, generally, I would know what application needed to be swapped out for it, and more importantly, rather than, this isn't just a blind, oh, I'm going to make all this stuff not proprietary, I'm going to make it free. I had a lot more confidence in the free versions of everything that I gave him, meaning that I have seen people, I know people, I've tried to support these people who will absolutely have catastrophic crashes or problems, systems breaking, whatever, due to the proprietary applications that they're using. Or if not that, then it will be a situation where they need to get something done and there's just not an easy way to do it because something proprietary is standing in their way. Specifically a lot of the media kind of related stuff. It's easier to fix them by just avoiding them altogether. And that is, in my mind, the advantage of taking the proprietary parts of a proprietary system and swapping them out with the open stuff. Oh, and by the way, yes, he did get a video editor, Open Movie Editor, exactly what he needed. He was editing home movies in no time, and I mean in no time. It was really cool, and that's an X11 application ported over by some resourceful person over at MacPorts, so that was really cool to see. Next, we'll talk about the Linux partition. First thing is first, and that is XFCE for absolutely rocks. I am amazed at how nice it is, and I know that Droops did a Hacker Public Radio episode on XFCE, and he did a great job of it. I mean, he really sold it on me, but I never needed it, I didn't really feel a huge need for it. Well, on this guy's computer, on the one I'm talking about, the little 8-gig partition, he doesn't have a whole lot of RAM, so I wanted Linux to run really, really well. I didn't want to stick him with GNOME for two reasons. Number one, because I didn't know if GNOME would actually run really, really fast, because I wanted there to be a noticeable difference. But number two, because I don't know GNOME, and I don't particularly care to use GNOME, and I don't particularly care to have him use it, because I don't feel like it's going to sell people on the Linux. I'm not that crazy about it. Nothing wrong with it, I'm just not that fond of it myself. So I thought, what might be a really great idea is just to put XFCE on here, because I know it's supposed to be fast, and I know the last time I used it, it seemed really, really robust, like lots of cool little features that kind of bring it up to really just normal file manager, desktop environment kind of place. So I installed Fedora 10, the XFCE version. No, not the XFCE version. Sorry, there is no XFCE version. The GNOME version. And then I added XFCE after the fact. Or actually during the install. I was installing, plugged it in, hardwired it in, added a couple of, added the extra repo or whatever. And then I said, customize this. And then I checked on XFCE desktop environment. That's what I did. And that installed everything. It was really nice to do it that way. I hadn't really done a Fedora install via the internet before. It took a little bit longer. I was a little bit concerned after a while because it was taking longer than I thought. Then I realized it was taking longer because it was getting all the updated packages from online. So that was actually quite nice, because then after I was, after it had finished, me and the user sat down, and lo and behold, it was already all updated. It took me a couple of times. I kept doing yum update, and it wouldn't update, and I couldn't figure it out, and then I realized it was because I'd done it over the internet. So that was nice. So yeah, XFCE, boot into that, it's beautiful. And it's really nice. And I posted some pictures of the little setup that I eventually came up with for him on unixporn.com. Just go to Miles, M-I-L-E-S, that's his name, Miles. Go to that site, or go to unixporn.com and find his user profile. And there's about four pictures on there of the desktop and some of the things that I was doing with the system. And it's really nice. I put a nice theme on there. It looks a little bit OS X-ish, so it's going to be really familiar for him. You know, if he reboots into Linux, reboots into OS X. I mean, literally, some people can't even tell the difference. They just have no eye for subtle differences, and, you know, they see pretty colors somewhere, and as far as they know, it's the same system. So I think, and then, like I say, a lot of the applications are this exact same ones. Firefox for Firefox, Thunderbird for Thunderbird, Pigeon for Adium. Well, not the same, but they both have birds as their logos, so things like that. It's going to actually be pretty cool. Why choose one distribution over another? I thought of this because I was on my way to this guy's house, and I'd mentioned Linux to him, and he seemed pretty interested in it, so I knew that it was probably going to come up, and best case scenario, I was going to be able to do a Linux partition on his computer. But the big question then was, which one should I install? And this is a good question, I think, and I think this is one that, again, Art V61, Evil Azimuth, was kind of asking and talking about, not specifically about distributions, but just there being so many choices in the Linux world, how do you know which one to choose? How do you know where to go? Or for us geeks, and we're setting someone up with a Linux distribution, you know, which one is going to be best for our user? I mean, you don't want to, I mean, really, stepping away from the whole, you know, Linux versus the world debate, as a geek their proclaimed system administrator, whether they know that term or not, if you're the one they're always calling when something breaks, you're the sysadmin, right? So it's your duty, really, to make sure that you, and it's to your advantage, to make sure that the user isn't calling you every other day, right? You want their system to work. You want it to hum and purr and work and not break. These are all good points. And these all, I think, play into which Linux distribution you might want to try out for a certain user. And this is obviously simply my methodology. It's my reasoning. It's specifically designed, I guess, for the people that I have so far come into contact with who keep asking me to help them with their computers. And so don't take this really any more than my observations, and certainly form your own observations based on your set of users and see what, you know, is going to work best for them and stuff like that. But I thought about it. I thought I might talk a little bit about it. So for Miles, my friend, specifically, I installed Fedora 10 with XFCE. And the reason I chose Fedora 10 was because it was stable, right? The current Fedora is 11. Well, 10 is kind of tried and tested and true at this point. I mean, they've ironed out the bugs. They've updated the software. You know, they've got it to a really nice point. If someone stays at 10, they can kind of be comfortable and settle in and kind of, we can know that most of the applications are just going to kind of work the way they're supposed to work, and that'll be that. The reason I chose Fedora was, I guess, largely because of their emphasis on the freedom, as in FSF, aspect. I mean, I am a little bit of a cynic, and I don't have any illusion about, you know, Red Hat just loving the Free Software Foundation, or any illusion about the Free Software Foundation, for that matter. I realize that all these entities and all these things are you know, they're businesses, or they're groups that kind of have their own special interests in mind, and that's just kind of the way the world works right now, and I realize this. But the community that creates Fedora, in my mind, in the experience that I've had, really is largely dedicated to and drawn toward the free stuff. And I like that a lot. They also make pretty good case for the free stuff. You know, they actually do promote it, whether Red Hat itself is solid behind it or not, or whether it's just a good business practice for them, I don't know. But I guess what I'm trying to get to is that their PR campaign, it concentrates a lot on freedom, on the free software. This is kind of one of those things where, this is one of the big problems that a lot of people do have with Fedora is that, yeah, it doesn't ship with MP3 support at all. It makes it's a little bit difficult. Is that taking away your choice, or is that asserting a really great PR campaign that really they're only going to do free software? I think the latter, although rpmfusion.org does exist and it makes it very easy to get MP3 support, so I'm not really sure if there's that much a case for the former. But I think of it as a sign that Fedora is saying, we are concerned about freedom and we're going to ship free stuff. But even more than that, I think Fedora is just, it's the best presentation you've got, really. I think this is very true. If you, as the geek, spend a fair amount of time setting up the computer for the user. You know, you don't just install it and walk away, right? You install it, you do a kernel mode setting if you have to for Plymouth, or it might be automatic, but I always have to do it because I'm always doing it on MacBooks, and they're always, they always need the little VGA code appended to the kernel. Then you do, you know, the installation of whatever codecs the user does want. You know, if they need MP3 or whatever, if they want that, install it for them. Again, you're kind of the sysadmin here. Installing all the essential software that they need, you know, their Office software if it's not already there, or their, you know, the games that they want, or Inkscape, or, you know, whatever they need. Do all the settings of the default applications, you know, make sure that Firefox knows it's the default web browser, make sure Thunderbird knows that it's the default email client. Make sure that when you click on a podcast from Thunderbird, it knows to open it up in Exhale, and so on. You configure the chat client so that when they click on the chat thing to investigate what that's all about, they're already signed in. You know, it has their information in there. It's got their little Gmail account or whatever they're using. You know, they've got it all set up so that they can start talking. You know, you spend that time and make sure that their little installation is a finely tuned installation. You set it in front of that user and it's going to bring tears of overwhelming joy to their eyes. I've seen it happen. It's a wonderful, wonderful experience. There's just not another distribution out there right now that provides that kind of smooth, slick, visually beautiful boot process, you know, with a Plymouth thing. I've got Spinfinity as his Plymouth boot screen, and it's just, it's gorgeous. It's got Fedora, and it's got this little thing doing this little infinity symbol, and it's got a progress bar at the bottom. It's a beautiful, beautiful, wonderful thing. There's obviously just great art, you know, there's just fantastic looking artwork for the desktop and for the window borders and the icons and stuff like that. So yeah, it looks really nice. You know, it's I think the overall presentation really, really rocks with Fedora. And I guess that's why I chose Fedora, because I knew, especially in, you know, his particular case, if we're still talking about him, and I guess I still am, it's really kind of like he's going to reboot and he's going to go into Linux, and then he's going to reboot and go into OS X. I want them to be comparable. I don't want the OS X one to look professional and the Linux partition to look kind of thrown together and hacked together. Again, this is going to largely depend on your audience. There was a time where I would have hated the professional-looking stuff, and I wanted really just the hacked-together stuff, and I still am. I mean, I don't really care so much about Plymouth screen myself. I don't really have that set up on my own MacBook, even though all it would take is a simple appending a little code to the end of my the grub.conf file, but I don't really care about it. But for this particular user, I wanted it to be a similar experience on both partitions, and so that's why I chose Fedora. I also liked Fedora for its, as opposed to, for instance, Slackware, for its, you know, available package manager. I was a little bit nervous about installing something with a graphical package manager where he could get in there and start screwing things up, because you know users are going to do that, right? I mean, for whatever reason, a user sits down at his or her computer, they know they're dumb users, right? They know they don't know anything about computers. They know that if they screw anything up, they're going to be completely off the computer until they can get you back over there to fix things. And yet, rather than sitting down and just clicking on Firefox and doing their little email thing and their little MySpace thing and their Facebook thing and their YouTube thing, they click on, you know, Package Manager, select everything that looks like it's installed, and click Uninstall. And suddenly they don't have internets anymore. They can't find their emails anymore. They're gone. They killed the internet. So they're going to do it. I was a little bit apprehensive about including Fedora on there, but this guy's a smart guy. I think I can trust him with a GUI package manager. This was the conclusion that I reached later, because he did seem like he was interested in getting in there and playing around with it. So I was like, okay, I'm going to give him a fully featured, easy, you know, kind of Linux distribution where he's going to be able to add software pretty easily. He's going to be able to remove it. Hopefully he'll just do the right thing and be smart. Whether this happens or not remains to be seen. My other option as I was thinking about what to install was Slackware. And this is what I run a lot of times. I mean, I always have it on a machine, if not a couple of machines. I love it. It's great. It works really, really nicely. And I choose Slackware when I choose it because it does work really nicely. You configure it and it works. And it just works well. You know, it's not just that it works as expected. It's that it works really well. That it actually does everything that it's supposed to do times 100. Well, okay, times 10. It's really a finely tuned kind of system. And I don't know why. I'm not technical enough to tell you why it does this. I just know that when I install it, I'm really happy with it. It runs really smoothly. It does exactly what I need it to do. And it does it faster than any of my other systems. So putting this on someone's machine, you might think, why would you ever put Slackware on someone's machine? Well, again, this isn't the kind of situation where you're just installing something and walking away. And Slackware, as a pre-configured installation of Linux, is actually a really, really beautiful thing, and in some cases, one of the smartest things you could ever do. Because, at least on Slackware, I find it's harder for them to screw it up because it's not necessarily as friendly. Especially if you remove a lot of the really dangerous applications from the K menu, they're not going to click on stuff. And you can do this with Fedora as well. You know, you can just remove PackageKit from the K menu or whatever menu you've got set up for them, and then they're not going to screw it up. So it's possible on anything. But my point is that with Slackware, you can install something, and it's just going to keep running. And it's not going to really give them the opportunity to mess things up because it doesn't try to do too much for them. And that's a beautiful thing when a distribution isn't constantly reminding them about updates and, well, you need to do this, you need to do that. Well, maybe they don't need to do this, and maybe they don't need to do that. Maybe what they've got right now is exactly what they need for the next 10 years. And you might laugh at that 10 years. Well, I mean, when was the last time you had a user come to you fresh off of, you know, Mac OS 9.2.2 or fresh off of Windows NE looking to upgrade to something because they heard that apparently computers have grown a little bit since they last used one? These are the kind of people that I'm talking about. So, I don't know, I find Slackware quite nice to install for people. I really do. I find it very, very well tuned. I find it a pleasure to install, a pleasure to configure, a pleasure to witness, you know, and I update it to current, and I set it in front of them, and I walk away, and they don't, well, I don't, I mean, I configure things for them. I make sure that everything knows what to interface with, you know, back and forth. Of course, with KDE, a lot of that's quite easy. A lot of that's already done for you, so that's another kind of neat reason to use. I mean, there's a lot of integration with KDE, so that's kind of nice, but, you know, still set it up for them. Put in their email into contact, put in their chat identity in Copete, and in, you know, conversation or whatever else you're going to have them do. So yes, Slackware is very good. So obviously the one that I haven't mentioned, the big one that I haven't even talked about yet, Ubuntu and or Linux Mint. I mean, to me they're basically the same. And Ubuntu is Ubuntu. It's easy to install and it's easy to use. And you know who it's perfect for? I find it's not perfect, at least in my experience, it's not perfect for the dumb user, trademarked. It's not these people who are going to break the computer that you're giving them or setting up for them or whatever you're doing. To me, it's more, in my mind, Ubuntu and even Linux Mint for the geeks to be, you know, the people who are coming from OS X and Windows and they heard about Linux, they're probably not even talking to you because they're doing this on their own. Ubuntu and Linux Mint and stuff is really a cool one for them to use, at least to dual boot into, you know, Slackware and an Ubuntu system on the same computer. Now that's a computer that's going to work well for the average noob, because that way they can go into Slackware and get confused and spend 3 days trying to figure stuff out, and then when their report is due, they'll reboot into Ubuntu, type up the report, print it out, and go to school. You get what I'm saying. You know, you've got the Ubuntu is a great, just kind of like, I'm determined to use Linux, but I can't do it on Slackware or on Arch or whatever, because I just don't know enough yet. So I'm gonna use Ubuntu so that I can not use Mac OS or Windows. You know, and that's where I see Ubuntu kind of filling that kind of niche. Does Ubuntu also fill kind of that? Hey, we need a really good Linux system to pre-install on our computers. In a way, yeah, and in a way, no, for me. I mean, Ubuntu is something that we can definitely all, we could rally behind it and say, this is a really good system, everyone should install it, you know, sell it on your computers, Dell, please. And that's kind of nice. And the big businesses like Dell, you know, they kind of need a distribution that they can focus in on, because you can't just say, Dell, when someone calls up and asks for such and such a distribution, install that. You know, you kind of have to allow for the idea that they're going to need a representative from this big group of Linux distributions. They need something that they can focus in on. Is Ubuntu the one that I would have chosen? Maybe not. Maybe it is. I don't know. It's a hard question because it's a hard position to be in. For us to have to choose a distribution that will kind of like be the public face of Linux, could we do better than Ubuntu? Could we do worse than Ubuntu? It's just kind of, you know, it's just one of those questions. So the couple of times that I've installed Ubuntu and or Linux Mint on someone's computer and said, there's your Linux system, it hasn't really gone that well, partly because I didn't do enough to pre-configure their environment for them, and partly because they just got in there and mucked things up, because, again, there are just too many notifications that they could potentially click on and really screw things up. So that's my thought on that, I suppose. Mandriva and PC Linux OS. Both of these are really good. I used Mandriva for, what, a year on my triple EPC? Nothing but good things to say about it. I would just as soon use Mandriva as I would, for instance, Fedora or something like that. I mean, it's a good, solid kind of user-centric distribution. PC Linux OS, same thing. I didn't use that for very long. I just used it that 1 or 2 weeks that I was working on some articles and just decided to work on them on random distributions for no good reason. It was good. I'd worry a little bit about its use of KDE 3.5. Point, you know, 10 or whatever it's using, which for me is kind of a liability, especially if I'm going to put it on someone's machine and hopefully, ideally, not have to go back and update their system a lot. You know, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily want to stick them on 3.5.10. I would probably just want to get them settled into 4. But both of those are really good, and they're definitely install disks that I like to have on me, you know, in the rare event where someone's like, I want Linux, and I try Fedora, I try this, I try that, and just one little thing isn't working right, or something huge isn't working right. I'll try Ubuntu, try Mandriva, try PC Linux OS. These are all good versions of Linux for when you just either don't have the time or don't have the patience to sit there and troubleshoot as to why, you know, the HDA SND_HDA_Intel isn't being recognized, or whatever. So those are good distributions. Debian, of course, Debian is a good one. Again, it's kind of hard to figure out Debian's place in the world, I guess, because in a sense, you've got Debian already covered. It's Ubuntu is Debian, or Debian is Ubuntu, and neither are actually the other. So Debian is good. I've used it. I actually have it on one of my computers right now on a PowerPC. It performs great, obviously. But what are you going to do with it? You know, what niche does it fill? For me, it fills a Slackware with benefits kind of niche, and that's just how I treat it. You know, when I install it without X, and then add X and the graphic user interface that I want to use with it, foregoing the whole GNOME thing. But if I was doing it for someone else, if I was installing it on someone else's computer, I wouldn't want to put them on GNOME because I can't really support GNOME over the phone or over chat. You know, I just don't know it well enough to do that. So I would probably, I would either sit down and sit there and do the manual labor so that I'm configuring it all from scratch, or I would just opt for Kubuntu or something like that. So that's kind of what Debian is for me. It's either Ubuntu that you have to custom build, or it's Slackware with a nice repository of like a lot of applications just ready to be downloaded very quickly. And then there's every other distribution out there, right? I mean, there are so many Linux distributions, and yeah, these are a lot of choices, but to someone who's vaguely familiar with Linux, after a while you start to focus in on the ones that fill whatever need you feel you need. For some people, there's never really a need for a solid system. You know, as long as they can get their data backed up onto some kind of hard drive, external hard drive, you know, away from the system so that when they distro hop again, they have all their data. You know, sometimes there's just no need for a long-term kind of system. For other people, there's a definite need for a long-term system that's going to perform for them on a daily basis. It's not going to take a lot of maintenance, that kind of thing. Some people need a really, really fast, sleek, and slender distribution. Other people don't really care so much because they've got a big, powerful computer and they can afford the eye candy or the pretty GUI or whatever. So obviously this is where the person just gets to come and make their own choice. You know, there's lots of distributions out there. There are a couple with a very steady and predictable release rate, and then there's a couple that there are many without that. You just make your choice based on your requirements. If you don't know what your requirements are yet, just start trying different ones out, whatever strikes your fancy. There's this kind of very weird truth about distros, and that is that they're all practically the same, and yet they're all different in just enough ways to make them not on your, you know, top two or three list. It's almost inexplicable. You know, you've got all these distributions, and there's, I mean, what's the difference between Citix KDE and, you know, Fedora KDE or Slackware with KDE 4? I mean, you'd think nothing was different, right? But if you install one and start using it and you're used to another, there are just those little things, whether it's just kind of a couple of configuration choices that they made, or whether it's just the way that it's building up some of its little subsystems. You know, maybe it's not looking at a file that on your other system it's looking toward for its for the way that it sets something up. You know, there are minor differences here and there sometimes, and after you kind of settle into one, some of those minor differences are kind of the deal breaker, because let's face it, at some point you don't have to distro hop anymore. At some point you kind of do. You have to figure out what you like, what you need, what you can use, what you find easy to use, what you find fast, you know, whatever. But at some point you don't need to do that anymore necessarily. You can get your work done on this distribution, and so that is your distribution. That becomes your distro of choice, or your distros of choice. If you're like me and can't really ever make that total decision, you can split the difference between two or three or four. Okay, so yeah, choice is good. Don't get overwhelmed by it. Just look at it in the eye and try it out. Test things out. Get used to some different ones, and eventually you'll settle in on something. If you're the local geek and you're building up other people's systems, just kind of get to know some of these things, get to know some of the strengths and weaknesses of each distro, and I guess just make your choice based on what you think that user is most likely to need and what their propensity is for screwing things up. Okay, that's the end of episode 13 of season 4. It wasn't so bad, was it? I mean, there was some proprietary talk in there, but it was all very anti-proprietary, so hopefully the whole curse of 13 has not done us too much damage, and hopefully it was somewhat educational or informative or at least entertaining. So, enjoy your week, and until next time, I am Klaatu. I am reachable at klaatu@hackerpublicradio.org or klaatu@linuxcranks.info. My IM is notklaatu@jabber.org. If you are going to friend me or add me to your buddy list or whatever you call it, just send me a message. You know, just send me some kind of like heads up about how you listen to my show or you use Linux or, you know, something so that I know who you are, because I don't necessarily accept being added to people's groups or buddy lists or whatever just blindly. I prefer to know that it's a real person and not a fake person. So do that. The website for this show is thebadapples.info, so check that out for all the show notes and any important links and things like that. See you later.
Come celebrate 40 years of Unix at the Ohio Linux Fest from September 25th through the 27th. If you use GNU, Linux, BSD, OpenSolaris, or any Unix or Unix-like system, you belong at Ohio Linux Fest. Register free today at ohiolinux.org.